Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the Sydney Town Hall at the 2018 Festival.
Good evening, everyone. My name's Sophie Black. I'm the head of publishing at the Wheeler Centre and the former editor of Crikey. And on behalf of the Sydney Writers Festival, I'd like to welcome you to the Town Hall this evening for this amazing conversation. This is not a moment, it's a movement. Now, before we kick off, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and who are the traditional custodians of the land, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Okay, so let's recap, shall we? The past 72 hours, The Washington Post, or more specifically, Irin Carmon, who sits before us, has exposed more allegations against the broadcaster Charlie Rose via 27 more women. The Nobel Peace Prize for Literature has been cancelled due to sexual assault allegations, and celebrated author Juno Diaz has withdrawn from this very festival in the wake of the brave decision of author Zinzi Clemens to speak out. So there's a bit to cover off on. I'll start with the introductions, though. We have three completely amazing and overqualified journalists here tonight to tackle the ongoing ramifications of the Me Too reckoning. Irin Carmon teamed up with the Washington Post's investigative team last November to break the long-buried story of sexual harassment allegations against Charlie Rose, which resulted in the television host's firing from CBS and PBS. In the last few days, she's published the follow-up investigation, which contained allegations from 27 additional women. Irin is the co-author of the best-selling book, Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and a contributing writer to the Washington Post's Outlook section. Previously, she was a national reporter at MSNBC and NBC News and a staff writer at Salon and at Jezebel. Tracy Spicer is an author, broadcaster, and co-founder of Outspoken Women. Her TEDx talk, The Lady Stripped Bare, has been seen by more than 4 million people. And that's probably outdated by now, I reckon it's more than that. And her memoir, The Good Girl Stripped Bare, is a bestseller. Tracy is spearheading the Me Too investigation in Australia, and in March she launched Now Australia, a non-for-profit organisation that aims to end sexual harassment across Australia's workforces. And last but not least, Jenna Wortham. Jenna is an award-winning technology reporter and staff writer for the New York Times magazine. She's also the co-host, alongside Wesley Morris, of the New York Times podcast Still Processing. Prior to working at the Times, Jenna was a technology and culture reporter for Wired. In 2017, she was named as one of the most powerful people in tech in Ebony magazine's Power List. Please put your hands together for these amazing women. Okay, so let's get right down to it. For those of you who have just woken from a coma, or at least just don't check the internet obsessively like normal people, which I applaud, Juno Diaz has cancelled the rest of his events for the Sydney Writers Festival. And that is in the wake of sexual assault allegations that were originally voiced by Zinzi Clemens at an event here at the festival, then subsequently on Twitter. Since then, other women have published accounts of their own experiences. Now, one common response online to Zinzi, on Twitter mainly, has simply been the sentence, "I believe you." Jenna, how fundamental and how radical is it to see that line be repeated again and again in light of the way that women were previously treated when they chose to speak up?
It's tremendous. I mean, I can't even imagine how much that gesture counts for when you're trying to even muster the strength or bravery to speak out. And I think previously in eras before social media, you know, you were speaking one to one or one to few in terms of just trying to talk about what you'd experienced. And I think that has to be a big part of the reason, just that you can immediately feel people supporting you, and the opposite, I'm sure, but just that you immediately hear other women and men saying things as simple as, I believe you, that has to go such a long way for why this entire moment is building into a movement.
Do you agree, Irene, in that is it's incredibly significant and different response to the way you've seen women treated in the past in the media, not just as a journalist, but as a reader, to the way the way women have been treated or listened to?
Well, I mean, I think we all wear different hats, right? We wear hats as friends and obviously as human beings. For me, when I'm wearing my journalist hat, it's sort of you have to report out the story to the best of your ability. On a human level, you know, having spent hours and hours talking to women who have waited in some cases decades to tell their story, it's an enormous responsibility to listen to them. I think there is, at least in other conversations that I've had about this, I think that there's a notion that it's become easy. Mm. Because it has become easier, it is easier, because I can say the story that you referenced, I first tried to do in 2010, and the women were not ready to speak, and I had to move on. And when people started sharing their own stories on their own terms, I thought, maybe it's time to go back to this story. Maybe they are now feeling like it's safe enough to tell somebody, the public, about what happened to them. But it's still not easy. It's still something that requires you to lay bare any skeleton you might have in your closet. Because apparently somebody has to still be perfect in order to be a victim of a sexual offense. And you have to have, I don't know, a diary you kept at the time that keeps all of the information. I guess what I'm saying is, it certainly is a sea change. There's been incredible journalism, including by Jenna's colleagues and by folks around the United States and the world, and there's been first-person storytelling. But just because the window is open just a tiny fraction, and we've come to a place, I do believe, that we haven't been before, I think it's important to not lose sight of the fact that this is not happening willy-nilly, that people are not just kind of doing it for fun. Having been up close in the machine and the aftermath, it is not fun. It's not glamorous just because a few people went to the Oscars.
Tracy, you find that you speak to women virtually every day, and many of them will only speak on condition of anonymity. So there is still a real fear there.
There's a long way to go. Every time I speak publicly, I say two words: believe women. Because the rate of false accusation is infinitesimal. And without commenting directly on the Juno Diaz case, without professing to know guilt or innocence, in a perfect world, there would be a judiciary where you could go and talk about sexual assault and rape without being asked how much you drank or how short your skirt was. In a perfect world, decades previously, the police would have taken you seriously when you went up and said, someone grabbed me on the bum or someone grabbed me on the boobs. And in a perfect world, newsrooms would have taken these stories seriously half a century ago. But unfortunately, the institutions in society have been male-dominated for so long that it's only now that women feel comfortable about telling their stories. It is not perfect for women to tell their stories on social media. It is not perfect at all, but I understand the frustration.
Specifically with this Juno Diaz story, but I think the themes mirror virtually any of the Me Too stories. People kind of split into different camps. There are reactions from people who express solidarity with the victims of abuse who've chosen to speak out. There are reactions from fans who are shocked and saddened by the revelations about their artistic heroes. And then there are those who moved within those same circles who say they're not surprised, who said that it was an open secret, who heard the whispers. Jenna, I've heard you say on the podcast Still Processing before that open secrets can be the most toxic secrets. What do you mean by that?
In reference to that in particular, I was earlier this year, there was a list that was circulated in New York naming men who were, and people really who were purported to be abusers of women and had varying different things that they were being, that were said that they had done. And I wrote a piece for the Times Magazine about how, despite having worked in New York for almost a decade, I didn't know about most of those people, but they were these open secrets. And I think that was really in response to just acknowledging how toxic and how detrimental it can be for everyone to assume that everyone knows, and that's enough of an infrastructure or enough of a system to offer any sort of protection, because that had not been my experience. I had gone to drinks with those people, I had been alone with them, and I was a young 25-year-old just from San Francisco who didn't know any better, and so I'd been in these situations that it could potentially have been really dangerous, and because they were open secrets, somehow the impetus was on me to know that was a dangerous situation. And so that's really what I was referring to in the ways in which women are left vulnerable. And in my case in particular, I think, you know, there was this idea that I would have been tapped into maybe what's known as a whisper network, or somebody would have told me, be careful, stay away. But either I wasn't seen as vulnerable, or I wasn't interacting with the people who were privileged enough to have that information to pass it along to me. I wasn't ranking on a hierarchy of knowledge. So that's really what I'm thinking about, which is we've developed these coping mechanisms to deal with these societal problems that are really insufficient. They put the impetus on us to understand how we're supposed to move around these toxic behaviors.
I'm going to go right back to the beginning, and I'll come back to that notion of open secrets, but it might seem like 1,000 years ago now, but let's go back to that initial Me Too moment right after the Harvey Weinstein revelations and what came out of that and the uprising on social media that came out of that. But of course, Jenna, the Me Too hashtag was actually first launched in 2006 by the civil rights activist Tarana Burke, wasn't it? Why do you think it took this time around for it to resonate to the extent that it did and for it to stick the way that it has?
Well, I mean, I could jump in. I think about this a lot because I've been doing this work for a long time in one form or another. Gender and politics and women's lives have always been things that I've written about as a journalist. And I always want to know, why does everyone care now about this thing? And this is true no matter what you cover, if it's considered a niche topic. You know, if you've devoted your time to covering police-involved shootings of unarmed black men, and then all of a sudden, what is it about this one that all of a sudden people care and editors care and people are sending satellite trucks to the site? And so I've been trying to think, there was Donald Trump, there was Bill Cosby, there were the men of Fox News. These were all stories that were reported before Harvey Weinstein in brilliant ways, really important journalism happening, really important storytelling happening. And I think that part of it has to do with, you know, the philosopher Kate Mann has coined this incredible phrase, himpathy, which is a disproportionate empathy that we extend to men. Yeah. And so many of these men that we're talking about right now that have been accused are men that we have an emotional relationship with, from reading them, from watching them on TV. We think we know them, so we feel betrayed when we learn something about them that is dissonant with that. But with the Harvey Weinstein story, the women who were coming forward were women that we also had that relationship with. You know, we saw Ashley Judd's name. Ashley Judd went on the record. And all of the victim-blaming playbook mechanisms that could happen, like, well, maybe she's just mad that her career didn't work out, or maybe she wasn't that good at her job and she just decided to do this, or this is revenge, or she wants attention. Well, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow doesn't need attention. Angelina Jolie, her life was pretty good before she decided to go on the record about Harvey Weinstein. And it makes me sad because I think we have this kind of this scale that we've set up, which is like, what about her lost career? What about the people who did suffer, who disappeared? You know, Wesley wrote a beautiful essay about Annabella Sciorra, these people who just disappeared, and now you understand why. But when I think about why that story was different, it's because we were able to extend empathy to those women that unfortunately the people who told stories about victimization before were not afforded.
And still aren't, honestly, because a lot of the stories we're still hearing or the reasons we're interested in is because there are these marquee names, and you think about someone like Angelina Jolie or Ashley Judd and Gwyneth Paltrow, right? Like you know, I remember reading that story and just being like, my God, you know, as if I hadn't heard similar stories from regular women, regular people that I know. And I mean, I think going back to your question, I mean, I wasn't as aware of the Me Too hashtag in 2006, but I can imagine it wasn't that level of celebrities talking about it. And there still aren't. And we're still predominantly talking about a very certain type of woman, an archetype of a woman who we kind of, you know, it feels really outrageous to think about harm and violence perpetuated against these certain types of women, and they're mostly white women, and they're mostly famous women, and women that we think have a certain amount of power. So, I don't know. I'm curious to see if we keep talking about these cases when they aren't marquee names and how we handle that and what we do about women who aren't just working in Hollywood but are working in the restaurant business, the tattoo industry, the design industry. I mean, the industries that aren't as sexy to talk about and aren't ones that we're directly interfacing and seeing on the cover of magazines every day.
And I think for that reason, there were a lot of women felt ambivalent or uneasy about that Me Too hashtag. On a personal level, and I'm not asking for specifics, I'm not asking you to name any details, but were you personally, all of you, compelled to join that Me Too hashtag at the time? Did you see the value in it? Tracy, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, definitely. I wrote a memoir last year in which I recounted pretty much every instance of sexual harassment and indecent assault that I'd experienced. And my husband said at the time, why are you sharing this? And I said, I want to stand with survivors to say we need to tell our stories about these everyday instances that have been normalized in women and girls' lives. So when the Me Too hashtag came out, I thought, finally, we can talk about that time that we were groped when we were 14 in our first job and know that we're not alone and know that we're going to be believed. So yes, I think, and with all the women who've come to me, I say to them, do you want me to connect you with counselling or legal help or investigative journalist support? And most of them say, I just want to tell my story to someone and be believed. That is the power of the Me Too movement.
What about you, Erin, as a journalist or as a personal Twitter user, what were your thoughts when you saw that bubbling to the surface?
I didn't participate. Yeah. I even though God knows I could have. I think I still feel like as a writer, I want to be standing a little bit outside. I wanted support in an ethical and responsible way, that kind of storytelling, but I don't see it my role to tell my own story at this point. That doesn't mean that that won't change, but that's just how I felt. And I also think doing feminist journalism for so long, I felt exhilarated, but I also felt fear and panic. I think a lot of people thought that last fall was fun for people, but it wasn't fun. It was like being on this horrible roller coaster, and it was important. It was like a train that you didn't know where it was going. But I've seen so many backlashes. And so I think when I saw all these Me Too things, I immediately thought, oh, the word's Me Too. Everyone's going to think, oh, people are just doing it because it's cool. And I know that that's not happening. And I think that I just naturally, I think again and again, I am humbled and learn from the fearlessness of other people. Because I think also journalists are cowards a little bit. Like you let somebody else do the heavy lifting and tell their story. And I think that if everybody thought like me, oh no, there's going to be a backlash. Oh no, this is not the right time. then we wouldn't have had this amazing transformation. Yeah. We wouldn't have had so many people creating a critical mass. I mean, just a couple of days ago, I randomly interacted with a man here in Sydney, and he was talking to me about how he saw what his wife and his daughters were posting, and his friends, yeah. and he teared up telling me about this. And he said, I didn't know, they never told me. And I thought, well, you probably didn't think to ask, but these are conversations that, yes, they're happening in the press, but they're happening on a personal level. And for some people, it might be the hashtag, but I know we've all had those conversations, and I've had those in my personal life. My husband saying to me, I'm thinking back at things that I should have said and done. And so I think we all participate in our own ways, public and private.
And there's a cynicism around the power of the hashtag. Did you have a certain cynicism towards the initial Me Too hashtag, Jenna, or were you right in there?
I was like Erin. I wanted to observe, and I also felt that the stories that were being shared, even though I had similar stories, they weren't at the same level, and so. One of the challenges of something like a hashtag like Me Too is that everything kind of gets compressed or sort of assumed to be on the same level of experience. And so I didn't want to take away, because I hadn't had quite the extreme experiences that some people were writing about and talking about. So I didn't want to detract from that. So there was twofold for me. But mm-hmm. I was humbled. I was in awe. I wept. I'm like emotional thinking about it. I mean, I think the scale is what moved the needle in terms mm-hmm. of, and I don't even mean like believable, like believability. I just mean in terms of getting even our institutions to care enough to start really covering it beyond just mm-hmm. celebrities. Like I think there started to be conversations where I work. Well, do we need to have a conversation? Like, what's going on here? And that, to me, felt like progress, not just writing about it. You know, here's this big, great big man that everybody knew was terrible, Harvey Weinstein doing things, but, like, let's actually look at our own foundations and, like, our workplaces and our relationships. Like, I got emails from people that, exes and people in my life, and, you know, I felt like that was really important, and I felt privy to conversations about consent in a new way. But my role, I mean, I wasn't covering it. I work for the New York Times, so I was in the institution kind of waiting to be tapped if needed. We talked about it on the podcast, but honestly, my role was to step up as a caretaker for my friends because mm-hmm. there are people very close to me in my life who had written books, worked it into things that were coming out. A very near and dear friend of mine worked it into a YA book that she's on book tour now talking about. And so I feel like my role is I check in on her daily. How are you? How are you doing? How are you holding up? Can I send you anything? What's going on? What do your mentions look like? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think that level of support is key because, Erin, you pointed out so beautifully earlier, it's like, it's easier, but it's not easy, and it doesn't stop once you disclose. But that's really the beginning, and you have no idea what's going to happen. And I'm thinking a lot about the woman who made this Medium end list. I mean, she's not employed. You know, people know where she lives. Like, I don't know what her anxiety levels are like. I mean, we're friends, but I reach out to her really regularly, and I'm just like, hey, girl, how you doing? Mm-hmm. Like, can I make you dinner? Because that's what community looks like, and that's what a network looks like, and that's what supporting women looks like. It's not just saying I believe you or necessarily a hashtag. It's like what from beginning to the end. Yeah.
Yes. Now, Erin, in the sort of midst of all of this, as the Weinstein revelations continued to roll out and the Me Too hashtag was exploding, you had a story that you had first started looking into 7 years ago about Charlie Rose. Would that story have got up with the Washington Post had it not been for the Weinstein revelations and the Me Too upswelling that followed from that?
No, and for a lot of reasons. I mean, everything in life is historically contingent, right? I mean, everything is a cause and effect. But in 2010, when I first began hearing rumors about Charlie Rose, and the rumors that I heard were about sexual assault in a workplace context, I tried to report on it. I was working at a website, Jezebel. I didn't really have the institution. I had the institutional support, but I didn't really have the institutional resources to give it the kind of investigative firepower that it needed. To be honest, I'm not sure I knew what I was doing. I've learned a lot in the last few months about how to do these stories, and I'm sure we could have some conversations. But the most important reason why it didn't happen in 2010 is that the women weren't ready to speak. Mm. And you can't do these stories without the consent of the people involved and the participation and their feeling of safety. And so what I'm cynical about is that I have seen reckonings come and go. Mm. I've seen people have to relearn the same lessons again and again. And so I sort of was cynically waiting for it to peter out, and it wasn't. And I thought, okay, I'm going to put aside what I'm doing right now, even though it might take over my life. And here I am 6 months later, it did take over my life, but it's important. No one has done the story yet, so it's my job to do it. And I went to the Washington Post, where I was a contributor, and they paired me with an investigative reporter. And before I went to the Washington Post, I started calling the people that I had been in touch with before and a few ones who had not gotten back to me. And all of a sudden, people were picking up the phone and telling me everything. Like, it was tumbling out of them. And one person even said to me, "I've been waiting for you to call. What took you so long?" And 17 days after my first meeting at the Washington Post, we were on the front page with three women on the record. And so it was easy to feel in that moment that it was easy, because it was so much pent-up desire to tell their stories. And so what changed because of those stories? One, these women were reading the stories of other people and thinking, mm-hmm. I'm not alone. That's 100% the most important thing to realize. Even though they second-guess their own behavior, what should I have done? Even though they think nobody cares, this isn't important, his career is more important, I don't want to bring down a good man. To the end of it, one of the women in our first piece talked about how she felt so much pity for him because he was an old man and he's going to be so upset when this comes out, and empathy all the way to the end. But you know what's funny? Spending time in a newsroom is that, and I think in casual conversation too, is that suddenly people really care about what women have to say in a way that they didn't before. Mm. And I think it's very easy for it to be turned into prurient gossip, or like some man would come down and then I would hear other men said, "Well, I never liked his work anyway," instead of thinking about the women who would put themselves on the line for this. Or they would be like, "Well, who's next?" And they would say to me, "Well, what about this guy who I don't like?" And you know, this is not your parlor game.
Yeah.
These are people's lives. The men too, it's their lives. But I think what happened, you know, the Washington Post also published a really important story about a Senate candidate in Alabama, Roy Moore. Three women described how he had molested them when they were young, when they were 13 and 14 years old. And that piece came out just as we were beginning our work on the Charlie Rose piece. And so I think the fact that institutions want to devote resources to these stories makes a huge difference. Whether it's because the New York Times did it first and we got to get our scoop, or whether it's because everyone wants to know or people are now ready to speak, just the act of thinking that these are newsworthy, I'm sure you have a lot to say about this, but the notion that these stories were private, right? Well, I don't want to get involved in gossip, and I don't want to get involved in a man's personal life. That also constrained the publication of these stories. And so I think we've now realized, you know what? Sexual harassment law in the United States falls under civil rights law. I'd love to hear more about the legal context here, but it is a matter of equality, equal access to the workplace. It's not a sex story. I mean, sexual assault stories may not involve the workplace, but these are questions of women's equal access to the public sphere. Mm. And so I think understanding that it's about that and not about gossiping about a sex, like a racy detail, and that requires listening to what women say about it, that's different too.
Tracy, I know that it was weighing on your mind when you were deciding whether or not to put a call out to women in the media to share their stories with you. I've read that you were, that part of that was triggered by guilt on your part. Is that right?
Definitely. We'd all known about these stories about Don Burke, the person we did the first story on with the co-production between Fairfax and the ABC, for almost 30 years. And I felt terribly guilty as a journalist in the Australian media for this long that we hadn't even approached those stories. But something that you said just sparked a memory for me. When I started out in journalism all those years ago, I was a police reporter at a radio station with a scanner next to the bed. And I kept hearing this code 10, code 10 at 3 o'clock in the morning. I said to the boss one day, what is a code 10 and why don't we cover it? He said, that's just domestic violence. What goes on behind closed doors stays there. It's a private matter. And I think a lot of us as journalists from that era internalised that idea of things like domestic violence or sexual assault or sexual harassment, which predominantly affects women. And we internalise that as, oh, that must be a private matter, it's not a news story, which in retrospect is not right. And that's why I always say question received wisdom, because it is not correct. So yes, that's why I sent that tweet out, because I felt guilty that we had never, here we were, privileged members of the media, a powerful institution in society, and yet we'd never reported on our own.
How many stories have you received to date, or how many women have come to you?
1,600 people have contacted me, and they've named about 100 different alleged offenders. It started within the media and entertainment sector, then it moved to politics, and now it's obviously retail and hospitality, the health sector, those areas where there's a huge disparity in power and pay. Very well-paid, very powerful men, very lower-paid, less powerful women. And what I'd like to see in this country is more stories on those kind of people experiencing sexual harassment, because while I do understand your point about empathy, before we see these women in Hollywood, we understand, gosh, if they've experienced it, imagine what it's like being on the factory floor. But we're not seeing enough of those stories from especially women of colour in this country, and women who are marginalised, who are experiencing this kind of thing every single day.
Yeah, and I think it's journalists' job to make people understand why they should have empathy. And I would never endorse the notion that we should only have empathy for the people whose names we see. It's just trying to sort of descriptively understand it. But of course, if people don't care about these stories, it's because we as storytellers have failed to tell it in a way that will generate that empathy.
And there is that, I mean, there is that criticism that Me Too has prioritized some victim stories over others, that some stories resonate and others don't. Do you think that that is changing? I know that the Time's Up movement in the US is trying to negate that and to definitely to broaden that out, and I know that the Now movement is also doing that. Is it working?
That's an interesting question. I was really moved. We were talking backstage. I was really moved to see the Time's Up movement in the U.S. back a hashtag campaign that was hashtag Mute R. Kelly, who's a singer in the U.S., who's been, has been charged so many times or accused so many times of molesting and being inappropriate with underage women, and it's gone ignored in the media, and his songs are still played on the radio, and this woman started a campaign on Twitter to get him off radio stations, to get him, you know, to cancel his bookings, to get him to stop being booked for large concert venues, to get people to talk about what women say he's done and what there's been, there's been all these different cases, and it seems like it's been working. Time's Up supported it. Ava DuVernay, John Legend, a few other very well-known Black Hollywood celebrities came out and said, we support this, Mute R. Kelly. And there have been some steps to disenfranchise him, and some of his lawyers have stopped working with him, although they refuse to say anything other. They have just said it's been a pleasure to work with him. So I think there is a certain amount of heightened socialized public pressure that's being applied that is bringing more attention to those movements. But I mean, even us up here, we're still only talking about the abuses that men bestow onto women. I mean, women abuse women too, and all of these things don't necessarily happen in a heteronormative format. So I think we're still figuring out how to deal with this endemic problem that is much bigger in scale and scope than we can even imagine. I mean, so to answer your question, I don't want to negate what's happening with R. Kelly, because it's tremendous and it's huge and it's unnerving how long he's been able to kind of escape scrutiny. But I definitely don't think we're dealing with it or talking about it at all in the way that we should be in terms of non-white, heteronormative, straight identified women, you know.
And we are figuring it out in real time, aren't we? What's the best way to do that? Is it just to be transparent, to admit when you don't know? Do you write through it? How do you all deal with that experience?
I think it's thinking about all these things from the get-go. For example, when we were building Now Australia over the last 3 months, we looked at what happened with Time's Up. We thought it was tremendous, but we thought that there was some things that we could improve upon. And one of those things was having representatives of all different communities from the get-go on our steering committee. We had a 40-strong steering committee and we made sure it was truly inclusive, because you've got to build that stuff into the DNA of an organisation. You can't think about it afterwards.
Mm. Yeah, it's a process. It really is. I had the privilege of being on a panel recently with the woman who's the head of the Female Farm Workers Union in the United States. And they were the ones that, after there was a march in the very early days of the Harvey Weinstein story, there was a march in Los Angeles by women in Hollywood, and they sent a letter on behalf of female farm workers, many of whom are undocumented and who are really vulnerable, truly, truly vulnerable if they make reports that might put them in the crosshairs of immigration enforcement in the United States. They wrote a letter to the Hollywood women and said, "We stand with you." So in fact, we tend to think about solidarity trickling from the powerful to the what we think of as the powerless, and there certainly is a power differential there. But I just thought it was the most beautiful gesture imaginable to say. They talked about, you know, there are important differences between what we do, but there are also commonalities and solidarity, and we support you. So I thought maybe we should be thinking about solidarity as an omnidirectional thing. Mm. And it's not something that just happens once. It's a process that you think about every single day. And the same thing in making sure that your journalism is ethical and responsive and is attuned to all kinds of power dynamics, whether they're power dynamics of sexuality or class or race or immigration status. It's not like you check off a box, as you say. You can't stop thinking about it.
Obviously, the online environment has been fundamental to the Me Too movement and unprecedented, and has afforded women an opportunity to effectively have a megaphone. How difficult can that be to navigate, though? Can that be problematic, certainly in a journalistic framework? Who wants to take that one?
That with people share their stories on social media? Mm. Well, you mentioned this, right?
Yeah, and again, I'm really torn about that because, look, this is a conversation that's not going to be very popular in this room, but it's something I've been wanting to say publicly for a long time. Mm. When we started doing these stories in this country, and I'd love to hear about the American perspective on this, we had the support of Fairfax and the ABC, and they were tremendous. Investigative journalism is costly, and it's difficult in this country because of our defamation laws. They say Sydney is the defamation capital of the world, and I think it's true. But recently, in the last 2 months, I've seen mainstream, what we would call old media organisations, starting to pull away from some of these stories. So that's why, as a freelance journalist, I've had the freedom to go to a lot of different organisations. I've got two stories that I'm working on with The Guardian at the moment, one with News Corp and one with the Financial Review, covering the whole spectrum from left to right, because this is not a thing that's in silos. This affects everybody. But I've been very sad to see some of the mainstream media organisations in this country actively say to me, we are pulling back from this story for a couple of reasons. Not only is it costly, not only is it difficult because of defamation, but it's getting a little bit too close to our executives. And that is a true story. And that is why I don't agree with trial by Twitter. I don't agree with people naming people on social media. But I understand the frustration why people are turning to what we used to call new media, because they feel a frustration with the gatekeepers in the mainstream media not putting the resources behind stories that need to be told.
Jenna, what's your take on that? What do you think about the idea of naming people on social media?
I think it's really ballsy, and I support people who need to be heard and feel that there are no other means to do it. And I don't know. I mean, as a journalist, it's tricky, but as a person, I mean, I am not afraid of messiness, and I think that that the instinct to keep things neat and tidy, I mean, it's different legally in the States, but I think the instinct to keep things neat and tidy for the sake of decorum or for the sake of not having tough conversations, it, you know, has let too many people get away with things that they should not be getting away with. I mean, I think a lot about stories that you know, we're talking a lot about stories that don't get told, and I hear about a lot of stories of trans women, especially Black trans women, who suffer from assault, abuse, you know, rape, murder, all the time on social media that I never, ever, ever see in news media stories or prioritizing. I've never seen a cover story about it. The life expectancy in the U.S. of a Black trans woman is, I think, 32. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's low. I mean, it's in their 30s, and that directly affects communities I'm a part of, and it deeply unsettles me and scares me. So I don't know. I think it gets complicated, but I don't know. I'm really here to bear witness to people who feel they have no other means of talking about what's happened to them.
I mean, if I could jump in, I'm of two minds, because on the one hand, I think depending on what the person wants, right? Maybe the person wants to tell the story on their own terms. Maybe they just want catharsis. I also worry for their vulnerability. There are, in fact, people in the United States, even though our defamation laws are not as skewed towards the person suing as here, there are women right now who are being sued for Facebook posts that they wrote about the director, Brett Ratner, for defamation. So the kind of processes that a good journalistic organization goes through to make sure that something is not defamatory is also protection for the women or for the people in the story. There's certainly safety in numbers, although the kind of implicit standard that we've come up with that there need to be multiple accusers for every bad person. Catherine MacKinnon, the feminist writer, remarked that this is like a woman is one quarter of a person for the purposes of these accusations. But certainly I've seen that in play in newsrooms. Well, how many are there? So telling your story through a journalistic outlet might conceivably allow you to be connected with other people that make there less heat on you. But I've also seen up close the limitations of journalism. So as you say, the gatekeepers, we are asking people who have been failed by institutions to trust another institution. These journalistic outlets are institutions, and any institution has its own systemic biases. And we're asking them to lose a sort of control over their story that they would keep if they told the story on their own terms. Even the most conscientious journalist is going to have to sit in a room with a bunch of different people, editors, lawyers, copy editors, just everything to filter through. And you can't run everything and you can't do everything. So there's a giving up of control. You know, we had a panel this morning about source materials in which it began with a quote from Janet Malcolm, who talks about how journalists betray their sources. Even the most well-meaning journalist ultimately cannot guarantee that the source will be happy with the way the story was told. And there's another problem, and you're mentioning Black trans women, I think, is on point. It reminded me that a few years ago I was doing a profile of a Black trans activist in New Orleans who had been helped by a program and then had become a program manager working on violence against trans women. And she told me a story about being sexually assaulted by a cop after being picked up on the street. And I wanted to include it. But here is what you need in order to publish that kind of allegation, and I'm sure that the bar is higher here. You know, she didn't know the name of the police officer. She wasn't sure what the department was. She wasn't sure what day or year it was. Did I believe her? I completely believed her. She had no reason to make it up. But the bar to get something published, and I know a lot of people, I hear so much from a lot of people who think just anybody can do this, but the bar to get something to publication is really high. I mean, the Washington Post just published a story about the television personality Tom Brokaw, in which the woman telling the story had kept a diary that was contemporaneous, and people still didn't believe her. But now is our standard that somebody had to have gone back and written down everything? You know, the women who accused Harvey Weinstein, one of them had a recording. And people still didn't believe for many years. And so many people don't even have that kind of evidence. And I think it is potentially re-traumatizing for somebody to have to then go through that kind of interrogation and that kind of scrutiny. And I think there's a greater good argument, but there's also a personal safety argument. And in particular, the most marginalized people are the least likely to have those kinds of, well, what paperwork can you show me? You know, that is something that is very biased to somebody who is already very comfortable with the system and not somebody who's been put outside of it.
And it is even harder in this country, isn't it, Tracy? We had Kate McClymont speaking on a panel a couple of days ago saying that so many stories are so hard to get up. So many of the stories that you have listened to, you just can't get them up because of the way that the defamation laws are set up in this country.
Because I've got such a large file now, I've got beyond a dozen accusations against many of the people who are alleged offenders. And even with that, you have to almost act like you're part of the police force. Yeah. Is there any clothing with DNA on it? Are there any diaries? Did you tell anyone at the time, a family member or a friend? And it is incredibly difficult in this country. So whenever you read these stories or see them on television, you know that they have been robustly researched. With Don Burke, for example, a team of 12 of us worked on that for 10 weeks, full time, until we got the first story up. Now, that is very arduous stuff. A dear woman I was talking to in a rural area the other day said, I kept clothing from this alleged rape. It has DNA on it. I've taken it to the police. I'm medically unwell. I've been diagnosed with cancer and I've just gone to see a lawyer so you can have this evidence in case something happens to me. That is the extent that journalists have to go to, particularly in a country like this, to build enough evidence for a case.
I'm going to give the audience the opportunity to ask some questions in just a second. There are two microphones down the front here, but I want to put one more question to all of you. We seem to have an opportunity here. This is definitely, Me Too is not going anywhere. But what do we do next? What do we do with it? How do we take this and ensure that it means long-lasting structural change? I'll give you 10 seconds of thinking time.
It'll just be brief, I promise. Might I suggest to everyone in this room to please send a tweet, a text, a letter, an email to whatever media organisation you like or subscribe to request that they continue to follow these stories. Because of our restrictive defamation laws and because of the fear about what's going to happen about the Jeffrey Rush defamation case, I worry there's going to be a full stop to the Me Too movement in Australia. So please, if you want to keep reading or hearing about these stories, contact the media outlets and say, we are interested in this. This is important.
So the reason that we kept reporting after they fired Charlie Rose from his fancy jobs, it wasn't because we wanted to come up with a really high number of accusations, 27 women. It was because we wanted to tell the story of how institutions aid and abet this kind of behavior or kind of absorb it for the sake of their important person. So there's a journalist in the United States, Juleka Lantigua Williams. I heard her talk about the value ratio, and I haven't stopped thinking about it since I heard her talk about this. She talked about how many women, people of color, otherwise people who we aren't used to seeing in charge or seeing as valuable in organizations, can be reassigned, shuffled around, demoted, pushed out of organizations for the sake of one person who we think brings value, and it's usually a man and it's usually a white man. That value ratio, is it, you know, dozens of women? For this second Charlie Rose piece that we did, the first woman who brought the complaint, who told her boss that he had said disgusting things to her, was in 1986. The most recent one we have, and they just filed a lawsuit, was in 2017, and she's 22 years old. So in fact, people had been complaining at the network where she worked since before she was born.
Oh my gosh.
So these are women who did the thing you're supposed to do. You're supposed to make a report. So we were thinking about, you know, what did they know and what did they do? Did they do anything? And the answer is they moved the women around and they kept promoting the powerful man whose value who they placed a far higher value upon. And so I think until we look at the institutions, which are often very banal, it's not sexy, it's not a horror movie about a bad man and an innocent woman. But until we look at how all of us are so inclined to look the other way just because we depend on this man for our livelihood, we admire him, we're just trying to do our jobs, we're just trying to get our paycheck, 1,000 small decisions like this add up to systemic abuse, and they implicate all of us. They include people that we love. They include people that we value. And it's a much more subtle conversation than the raw confession, and I hope that that's one that we continue to have.
Well put.
What do you think, Jenna? I have heard you speak beautifully about the fact that we need the tools, and I'm going to quote you directly now because you're so quotable. We need the tools to give us the language to know how to speak up for other people and how to step in and when to step in. And it's scary and it's hard to know, but that fear can't be the thing that keeps us from trying. There you go. There's an answer.
Thank you. I'm off the hook. You know, I mean, it's tough. Like, how do you reorganize society, right? Because we don't value women's lives, and we don't value, I mean, I'm thinking a lot about, the Times had this story about abuses that were being conducted against women, predominantly Black and Latino women in the U.S., in these Ford factories, and the women would say things like, I needed the job.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't, I have a felony. Like, I have, you know, I'm living within a system that is very difficult to survive within. My options are limited. That cannot be the cost of survival in our country. And yet it is. I mean, it just is, because that's the way it's been set up, and those women aren't seen as valuable. So it's a big question, and I really wish I had a brighter answer. I mean, I think reporters and the work that Erin does and the work that Tracy's doing as well, I mean, I think that's starting to crack it open, and it's not usually very visible, and it's not usually rewarded or commended. I mean, that's part of it. I think continuing to be squeaky wheels, if that's what we are, you know, in our organizations about getting attention put on these stories is part of it. But I also think, or when you used a phrase that that's like been reverberating around in my mind now, it's just like systemic abuse. I mean, we are all products and participants in systems that abuse women. And I don't know what you do about it. It's a tremendous and a gigantic reordering from the top to the bottom. And that is when you actually get structural change. And that's bigger than the four of us sitting up here. But it's essential. It's crucial. It's critical.
Well, I'm going to throw to the audience now. So if any of you have any answers, actually, no. I don't mean that at all. I just want short, sharp questions.
We're open to suggestions.
We don't have much time at all. Let's start over here.
Thanks for a really inspiring talk. I'm really grateful for the Me Too movement. About 3 days ago, I posted a photograph of my athletic 10-year-old daughter on social media climbing a telegraph pole, and I thought, wow, look at her muscles. And a man said, pole dancer. And immediately, seven men said, that is inappropriate. How dare you? She is 10 years old. Yeah. So my question is, I think social media, in the absence of the police, the justice systems, universities, workplaces, CEOs, they do not listen. In the absence of this, is not social media okay? Or what do we do to protect our daughters and the women who are coming up? Like, really, how do we protect our young women?
We teach our son not to be rapists and sexual assaulters.
What if we go to another... That was a good answer. We could just go to another question.
Yeah, I know. I have nothing to add to that. That's great. I mean, we should know... I guess I would just expand on that point and say I understand that a parent's job and desire is to protect, but I think rather than protect, we should think about the fact that we want to give young people the tools to move through the world as autonomous beings and to respect the consent of others and to demand it for themselves. I think my worry is that telling all these stories will lead us to want to swaddle vulnerable people and not allow them to go out and live their lives. And so I think teaching your daughter to be strong, teaching your daughter that she has value, which it sounds like you're already doing, but also it's not just a message that should be directed to women, as you say, because it sounds like there are already great men in your community who are speaking up. And I think the truth is, you know, even the biggest feminists among us, we still listen to men a little bit more. And I hate to say that out loud, but I really think it's true. We've been taught to value the things that men say. So until men come get each other en masse, until men speak up the way happened in a micro way on your Facebook page, we're going to keep having these conversations with each other. And that's really important. We need to have that. But we can't do everything by ourselves. Like, we're already really doing a lot.
I just want to add one thing quickly, too, which is I really appreciate your point about the ways, the value, the inherent value that social media has offered in recent years for us, for this moment in particular. But I really worry about depending so much on these companies, which are institutions, and they are either privately or publicly held. Their interests are not our interests. They're not neutral. They are benefiting from this. They make money off of this. And what happens when they stop, you know? So that's the, and they do use algorithms to prioritize information and decide what we get to see and what we don't get to see, you know? So I just, and I say that as someone who I feel so grateful to social media too, but it's something that's in the back of my mind as a former tech reporter. I'm just always really anxious about what happens when those companies don't share our values and we have no indication that they do, just because right now they're letting us use it the way we want to use it.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Next question. One more. Yeah. Sorry. Can you... at the back, sure. Can you tell I didn't wear my glasses and I can't see?
This is not my opinion, but what is your response to people who say that Me Too has gone too far?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking a little bit about how it's not easy. I think it's also, I wish people knew that what reporters publish is the tip of the iceberg of what they know, because it has to reach such a high standard. I mean, Tracy's really gone around this, and we've talked about the open secrets and the informal networks. What is too far? And what is the Me Too movement? Because, in fact, what's happening is completely organic, right? There's no central council of Me Too. Like, I've heard a lot of people say, oh, but isn't that ruining it for everybody, that this one person did something that I don't agree with about the way they told their story? But no, we don't all get together and say, like, you're good, you're not, you be quiet. Mm. This is a grassroots conversation. It's being mediated by journalistic and organizations and by activists and advocacy groups, but ultimately it's spontaneous. And so I think, yes, we need to have conversations that have nuance. We need to not replicate biases that have already been embedded in the criminal justice system, right? We don't want to create a panic that might disproportionately affect people who are already in the crosshairs of the criminal justice system, such as Black men in the United States, at least. But there's no central arbiter, right? Nobody is planning this. And I think we need to have conversations that are generous and open-minded about where this, about each conversation, about each person, because it dehumanizes the individuals who are each one of them on their own making a decision to speak.
Well said. My response is very simple, which is it would be, it hasn't gone far enough yet. I mean,
I think we've got time for one more question over number four.
Hi, I'm actually so glad that you guys are talking to me because the question that was just asked was, what do you say to people who say Me Too has gone too far? I'm actually one of the people who came forward to Tracy. Hi, Trace. Hi, darling. Look, for people like me, I heard you guys sit up there this evening and say that you feel responsibility as journalists when the audience can't empathize with the story that you're bringing. And that was concerning to me because I came to Tracy with my story last year and she followed up with me and said, look, you're not the only victim of this man, but we just can't get the story up. What I want to say tonight is, firstly, as journalists, you can only do what you can with the resources that you have. This comes back to the media organizations. You shouldn't have to be sitting on stage putting out a call, asking audience members to give you the resources to bring these men to justice. I have seen you do so much more than what your job description has asked of you. And honestly, the responsibility lies with the media organizations. So firstly, no, the Me Too movement has not gone far enough. I speak for myself and I speak for the other women who won't see justice because of what's acceptable and what isn't, and that's decided in an office. Secondly, I would like to ask you, as journalists and as women who are telling these stories, other than calling, tweeting, Facebooking Fairfax, News Corp, you know, everyone who we need to support you, what else can we do so that you keep being given the resources to tell our stories?
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
Honestly, you have done enough above and beyond by having the courage to share your story. And thank you for that, because it is stories like yours that will continue the momentum for this movement. But you're absolutely right. We have to say to each other, whatever our gender, whatever our background, continue to share these stories, continue to tell the institutions in society, whether it's media, legal, political, that this is important. This is not just a women's thing. This is not for the lifestyle pages. This is something that is a health and safety issue for people everywhere, and we need to address it seriously. So thank you.
And on that note, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Please join me in thanking...
Oh, before we do, can I just acknowledge one of Australia's greatest feminists, Eva Cox?
See, I don't have my glasses
right here.
On. Thank you, Tracy. Yes. I apologise.
Is the mic on?
Yes.
Oh, good. Thanks for that, because I just think we need to finish off with something more, because what we've talked about tonight, and very poignantly, is what happens to punishing the perpetrators. What we haven't talked about tonight is how do we stop men doing it? And I think that is the real challenge for us, because unfortunately, being an ageing feminist, I know that dragging every single perpetrator through court will not necessarily stop this, because people do not stop doing things just because there's jail. We need to do it because we need to catch them. But I think we need to do some serious thinking about where do we go, and I mean, I've already started having a conversation with Tracy about this, to try and stop that sense of rights. Years ago, we did a survey for the Human Rights Commission, and when we talked to people who'd put complaints in, what they wanted it to stop. And I think that's one of the things that we haven't really talked about, is not how do we stop that man doing it, but how do we stop men feeling that they're entitled to do it? How do we stop being the second bloody sex? And I just want to say that I think until we start seriously looking at what we do to little boys that make them feel that they're entitled, and I've got two grandsons and I'm watching yes. it happen to some degree, but I just think we really do need to sit down and start addressing a social problem, because we are still the second sex, we are still defined in male terms, and unfortunately a lot of what we're doing to fight this, apart from the fact that we're ganging up as women and supporting each other, is using a male-driven system to try and screw yeah. males, and it doesn't work.
Eva Cox, we need you up here on stage.
Thank you. You know,
thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for your contributions tonight. Please thank Jenna Wortham,
thank you, everyone.
Erin Carmon, and Tracy Woo-hoo! Spicer.
Thank you.